This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by PureFlix's Samson, the biblical story of the last of the Hebrew judges. Rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. Samson, in theaters February 16th. More information is available at samson.movie.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Well, thank you so much for joining us again. As American Christians, we often take it for granted that we are privileged to live in a nation that would not exist but for a group of pilgrims seeking religious freedom in a new world. But what kind of world did they come from? My next guest says you really have to understand the dynamics that were at work during the 16th century in the world of global monarchs in order to appreciate the huge paradigm shift that resulted in colonial America. So joining us today is William J. Federer, nationally known speaker, best-selling author, and president of Amerisearch Incorporated. And his American Minute radio feature is broadcast daily across America and by the internet. And his Faith and History television show airs on the TCT network on stations across the country and via DirecTV. Today, we will be talking about his book, The Treacherous World of the 16th Century and How the Pilgrims Escaped It. A great title, and I'm excited you're here, Bill. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Janet, great to be with you.
Thank you. Why would you say this time period is so key for us to understand, kind of, as you say, the prequel to America's freedom?
Well, we have revisionist history going on, and kids are growing up not knowing how unique America is. One of my favorite quotes is from Arthur Schlesinger Jr., a Nobel Prize winner that was on John F. Kennedy's staff. And the quote is, "History is to the nation what memory is to the individual." So if you can imagine an individual who has lost their memory, maybe right. They have Alzheimer's.
Right.
We have national Alzheimer's. Anyway, so we see the dynamics. The Muslims conquer North Africa, Spain, the Holy Land, and they invade into Turkey and Greece. And they cause the Greeks to cry to the West for help. The West sends help. It's called the Crusades. When they fizzle, the Muslims capture Constantinople in 1453. This cuts off the land routes to India and China, which gives an impetus for Columbus to look for a sea route. So Columbus would have never set sail had it not been for Islamic jihad conquering the capital of Europe, Constantinople. Anyway, the Muslims continue to invade, and they surround Vienna, Austria in 1529. So the Reformation had just started with Martin Luther, 1517. 1529, 100,000 Muslims surround Vienna. And so the Holy Roman Emperor is Charles V of Spain. He is the one who controls all the New World. He's taken the gold from the New World to fit out his navy to fight the Muslims from taking over the Mediterranean. And the Philippines are named after his son, King Philip of Spain. And so Charles V is faced with this double dilemma. Protestant Reformation on one side, 1517, Muslim invasion surrounding Vienna, 1529 on the other side. So he does something unique that had repercussions that even affected us. What was it? The Peace of Augsburg of 1555. This was the first treaty ever to recognize Protestants. And in there is a little Latin phrase that made a big difference. The phrase, cuius regio, ius religio, which means whose is the reign, his is the religion. In other words, each king got to decide what's going to be believed in his kingdom. Let's just work together against these Muslims who are invading Europe because they want to kill us all.
Wow.
And so this started a domino effect across Europe where different kings believed different things. And if you did not believe the way your king did, you were persecuted, you fled, Europe was thrown into this mass migration, and people spilled over and founded colonies in America. And I go through how each colony was started by a different Christian denomination. Virginia was Anglican. Massachusetts was Puritan. Rhode Island was Baptist. New York was Dutch Reformed. Delaware and New Jersey were originally Swedish Lutheran. Pennsylvania, Quaker. Connecticut and New Hampshire were Congregationalists, and Maryland, Catholic. Now, they did not get along. They would chase each other out of each other's colonies, sort of tar and feather each other. Very similar to Europe chasing people out of different kingdoms. It was not until the Revolution started that the Americans had to learn to work together, similar to the Protestants and Catholics under Charles V working together to stop the Muslim invasion back in 1555.
Right.
But it gives us a picture that they faced situations not a whole lot different than what we're facing today.
Yes. Well, there's so much there. I don't even know where to begin because there's so much history you've been able to very much condense into a very understandable scenario there. But when you're talking about this piece of Augsburg, for example, this idea that whoever is reigning, that's the religion the people are going to follow. How did that affect the situation that ultimately drove the pilgrims from England to the New World?
So Martin Luther brings the Reformation to Germany, translates the Bible into German. Henry VIII decides that he wants to have another wife. He's married to Catherine of Aragon, the daughter of the King of Spain. And after 18 years, she does not have a son. A daughter, Mary, but not a son. So Henry decides to divorce her. Well, the Pope won't recognize the divorce because she is, after all, the daughter of the most powerful guy in the world. And 6 months earlier in 1527, the King of Spain invaded Italy and arrested the Pope and imprisoned him for 6 months. So the Pope doesn't want to get on the wrong side of Spain. He refuses to recognize Henry's divorce, and Henry does something. He decides to make himself his own Pope. He starts the Church of England, puts himself on as the head, and he goes on to have six wives. And their fates were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. So Henry VIII was not a really nice guy to be married to.
No.
Interestingly, 3 years earlier, Henry VIII had William Tyndale killed for translating the Bible. William Tyndale's last words were, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." And so here, 3 years later, he divorces, and his advisors tell him that he needs an English Bible the same way the German kings got their German Bible. So what does he do? Basically takes William Tyndale's work and redoes it, calls it the Great Bible, spreads it around the country, thinking this will solidify my break with Rome, sort of dust his hands. But something unexpected happened. People began to read it, and they began to compare what's in this Bible to this king divorcing and beheading his wives. So a group starts that wants to purify the Church of England called the Puritans. Another group starts that wants to separate from the church. It's called separatists. The king is all of a sudden faced with what he thought was going to solidify his break with Rome. Now he's got all these groups starting, so he passes an act of uniformity. Everybody's got to believe just the way he does. If not, you get burned at the stake. This causes the separatist pilgrims to flee to Holland and eventually to America.
Right. Yes, exactly. That was kind of the thing that drove it all. So now when they went, as you said before, they made that other stop before they went to the New World. And a lot of people don't recognize why that was. So when they fled, why did they flee in the direction they did instead of directly to the New World?
Well, Holland had a little tolerance. It was breaking away from Catholic Spain. And so they had different seven United Provinces, and they all believed a little different, but they were willing to work together. And so it's called the Netherlands Republic. And they, interestingly, they invented companies. So during Catholic Middle Ages, there were no companies. It was a sin to pay or receive interest. It was called usury. And if you wanted to sail around the world, you need to hit up some rich guy to underwrite it. Well, the Dutch, after the Reformation, invented joint stock companies. So a farmer, a blacksmith, a cook could invest money in a ship going to Indonesia. When it came back filled full of spices, you would get paid a profit. If you wanted to sell your interest in the ship while it was at sea, you would go down to the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. And of course, they settled New Amsterdam, and they had a New Amsterdam Stock Exchange, which became New York Stock Exchange when the British took it over. And if you're the ship sank, well, the Dutch invented insurance companies.
Huh.
But the Dutch system allowed the amassing of capital to do this. And so they had the richest company, more prosperous than all the other companies combined, called the Dutch East India Company. They controlled island off Japan, Jakarta, Indonesia, Spice Islands, Goa, India, South Africa, and then, of course, New Amsterdam and New York. And so the British sort of modeled the Virginia Company after the Dutch East India Company. And so you had bylaws and so forth. Now, it's interesting. The Virginia Company went bankrupt, malaria, Indian attacks. And so they threw it in the king's lap, and he had to send over a royal governor. And the governor said, "Look, I don't want to be bothered with stuff. Just pay me money." And so the landowners had to meet together to find out who's going to pay what. It was called the House of Burgesses. A Burgess was a burger neighborhood.
Well, I'll tell you what. Hang on just a moment. We have to go to a break, but we'll come right back with William Federer. His book is called The Treacherous World of the 16th Century and How the Pilgrims Escaped It. Stay with us. We'll be back. When a cake artist declines to create a custom cake for a same-sex wedding, he's forced to defend his decision in court. That's what happened to Jack Phillips, and the Supreme Court is now deciding his case. Your religious freedom is under serious attack, and that's why your gift to Alliance Defending Freedom is needed right now. Just $100 helps Alliance Defending Freedom provide the necessary resources to fight these pivotal court battles. Call 866-700-1060. That's 866-700-1060. This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. Here's Michelle's story.
I had heard about Trinity, so I made the call. The people at Trinity are very friendly. They worked with me on planning a budget and putting money aside even for retirement. I learned to track all of my expenses. I write things down. The benefit is that I am now not worrying about my finances.
If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your accounts, put a stop to late fees, and reduce your interest rate by up to 60%. Save thousands and become debt-free for keeps. Trinity provides practical solutions and creates hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. 1-800-793-8752.
From PureFlix comes Samson, the biblical story of the last of the Hebrew judges, from his anointing to betrayal to redemption.
My name is Samson, and you will face the wrath of God.
Samson, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13, in theaters February 16. More information is available at samson.movie.
Back on Janet Mefford today and getting a really fascinating history lesson today from William Federer. His new book is called The Treacherous World of the 16th Century and How the Pilgrims Escaped It. Bill, you were talking before we went to the break about the House of Burgesses, and you were sort of outlining the history of how the Pilgrims went over to Holland and how these joint stock companies formed and how that all kind of morphed into what we know today as the history of the colonies. But what was the significance of the House of Burgesses?
And so these were landowners that met to find out who was going to pay what to support this governor. And they said, well, gee, while we're here, who's going to fix the roads? Who's going to fix the bridges? Who's going to defend us against the Indians? They began to make legislative decisions, and the royal governor really didn't care as long as he was getting paid. And it backdoored them into a legislative assembly. Now, the Pilgrims, when Spain threatened to attack Holland, the Pilgrims decided to flee again. They were going to go to Guyana in South America. They heard of the perpetual spring and the nice warm weather, but then they remembered of Fort Caroline. So this was the first settlement in North America. It was French Protestants settled near Jacksonville, Florida. Spanish found out about it and butchered them all. And so the Pilgrims said, well, we don't want to go to anywhere near where Spain is. And so they were going to go to Jamestown and submit to the now royal crown governor. Well, they get blown off course. And I tell the whole story how they had to keep going back and recalk their ship. And they land 500 miles off course in Massachusetts. They try going south around Cape Cod, but it's what's called the graveyard of ships. The sand shoals keep shifting, and there's 3,000 shipwrecks there. And so the captain almost sinks. He goes back to Cape Cod and tells the Pilgrims, get off. No more sailing. And they like raise their hand saying, we have a problem. There's no king appointed person on our boat. Who's going to be in charge of us? They do something unique. They give themselves the authority to start a government. It's called the Mayflower Compact. Right. We in the presence of God covenant ourselves together to form a civil body politic, to pass laws we think most necessary, unto which we promise all due submission. Simple, revolutionary. the whole world is ruled by kings and all their underlings. And this little hull of this little boat, like a womb, is a polarity change. Instead of a top-down form of government with all these kings and sultans and Chinese emperors, it's a bottom-up form of government where the little people amongst themselves decide who's going to get the power, and they can vote them in, vote them out. And so where did they get this idea? I mean, this is around 100 years before Europe's Age of Enlightenment. They got it from their pastor, John Robinson. He was a separatist, considered a founder of the Congregational Church. And so he was not an Anglican king-appointed pastor. He was a congregational pastor. And where, with this church model that everybody in the congregation votes, they simply applied that to the government and said everybody in the community votes.
Wow.
They took the church government and made it their state government. This became the model for the other New England colonies and eventually became the model for the U.S. Constitution. An amazing polarity change that took place. It's the difference between a dead pyramid ruled from the top down to a living tree, where every root and every little capillary root sucks in nutrients to keep this thing alive. So it's a citizen-based form of government. We can trace back to the pilgrims and their little pastor and this reformation of breaking away from the king-controlled governments.
That is so fascinating and so significant when you think about it. What was it about the Muslim Barbary pirates? You had mentioned before a lot about Islam and how Islam played a big role in the shifts in Europe and whatnot with taking over this land and taking over that land and the Crusades and all the rest. But is it the case that the pilgrims actually had altercations with the Muslim Barbary pirates?
Right. So the pilgrims saved up 800 pounds of beaver skins to pay off their boat ride. Hmm. You never ask ourselves who paid for their boat ride.
Right.
Virginia paid their debts with tobacco, but Massachusetts paid it with beaver skins. It was Squanto, the Indian that taught them how to catch beavers. So they had saved up 800 pounds of beaver skins, and the year is 1625. They send the ship back to England, and William Bradford writes in his History of the Plymouth Settlement, the ship was in the English Channel within sight of Plymouth, England, when a Turkish man of war captured it and took the ship and the crew to Morocco and sold them into slavery. Lo and behold, in 1625, the Muslim Barbary pirates captured 1,000 people from England. They would raid the little coasts and the little islands, and then they raided Ireland. There's the stolen village of Baltimore, Ireland, where the Muslim pirates round up the whole town, put them on ships, take them to Morocco. They capture 400 from Reykjavik, Iceland around 1630, round them up, take them to Morocco. And so the Europeans first had Catholic orders, like the Trinitarians, and the head of the order was called the Ransomer, and they would collect alms and donations and then go under a white flag to North Africa to get your friend back. But then the European countries transitioned to paying an annual tribute. So England, Sweden, France, Spain would pay millions of dollars to these Muslim pirates to leave their country's ships alone. Hmm. And the colonies in America were covered underneath of the British tribute until the Revolutionary War and the independence. And the Muslims said, oh, you're your own country. That means you're not covered by the English tribute payment. You got to pay up. And, of course, that's when they captured American ships, and Thomas Jefferson sends in our Marines, and right. It's called the Barbary Pirate Wars.
Right. That's interesting.
But even the pilgrims had to deal with the Muslim piracy. Now, one of the dynamics, in the 1500s, you had King of France is Francis I. King of Spain is Charles V. And Francis I is captured by the King of Spain, and he's forced to relinquish a bunch of his territories and lands. Well, when Francis is let out, what does he do? He does the unthinkable. He makes a treaty with Spain's biggest enemy, the Ottoman Muslim Turkish Empire. So here you have France selling out Europe. The rest of Europe wanted to excommunicate Francis I.
Wow.
Anyway, once the Spanish forces are now split, they lose a bunch of cities in the Mediterranean, and they're not able to defend Hungary. And so the Ottoman Turks invade Hungary and capture it, and they kill their king, King Louis. And so we see these dynamics beginning to take place that are sort of similar to today. You have certain groups want to sell out to the Muslims because it's to their benefit, while others want to try to protect Western civilization.
True.
And the other situation was that the Ottoman Empire stretched from the Persian Gulf all across North Africa. It had Spain for 700 years until they were driven out by Ferdinand and Isabella. And they had the largest battle of the Mediterranean. It was called the Battle of Lepanto in 1571. 230 Muslim ships, and they were powered by 15,000 Christian slaves under the deck, like Ben-Hur rowing.
Oh, wow.
And then there's the Holy League, which was the Austrians and the Spaniards and Genoans and Venetians. And they only agreed to fight together if Charles V's son led it. He was 25 years old, Don John of Austria. The battle, the wind is against the Holy League. They're just floundering, and the Muslims are about to hit them. And the admirals go to Don John and say, look, we can always fight another day. He said, no, we're here to fight. He gets them on deck. They pray. While they're praying, the wind shifts 180 degrees. The Muslim sails go limp. The Holy League sails fill up, and they smash into them, and they capture or sink 200 of the 230 Muslim ships.
Oh, my.
It broke the back. Now, instead of following up on that great victory and freeing the rest of the Mediterranean from the Muslim control, Spain sends its armada to smash the Reformation in England, and they send the Duke of Alba, the Iron Duke, to Holland, and he butchers and kills, it's called the Spanish Furies, in the 1570s to squash the Reformation in Holland. And then I take it the next step, and so when the Spanish Armada is sunk in a hurricane, all of a sudden Spain's invincibility is broken. And the other European countries say, hey, Spain's not as tough as we thought. Maybe we can start a colony in the New World. Hmm. And it was like an Oklahoma land rush. You got France settling New France, Sweden settling New Sweden, which became Delaware and New Jersey, okay. Holland settling New Amsterdam, which became New York, and then the English settling New England and so forth. And so it was this mad rush to hurry up and settle these colonies. But as I mentioned before, it was one denomination per colony. And it took a while for the idea of tolerance and freedom of conscience to develop. And that's what we're the inheritors of. So we need to remember all of the centuries of struggles that people went through so that we can be in America. We can believe what we want. We can dress the way we want. Kings used to decide the peasants could only wear gray and brown. Only the upper class could wear colorful clothes, you know. Hmm. We can wear what we want. We can eat what we want. We can go to the church. We have all these freedoms that they didn't have when kings ruled it and sultans ruled it. And if we don't know this history, then we're being told America's terrible. America's the problem in the world. It's like, hello, you want to go back to a king? You want to go back to a sultan or a globalist, you know? The King of England was like a globalist. You know, he controlled this global empire.
Yeah, that's right. Or tell some of these feminists, you can only wear gray, honey. Sorry, we're going to go back to the old ways. Oh, man. Well, how would you say, just briefly, I know because we're going to run out of time here, but how exceptional would you say it was for this small group of Christian separatists at this time to attempt to rule themselves with the Mayflower Compact? It was absolutely revolutionary.
Well, it really was. And they went to the Bible. And what did they look at in the Bible? Their sermons, they looked at the first 400 years when Israel came out of Egypt. And so here, Israel for 400 years had no king, right, before King Saul. Mm-hmm. And so this was the first instance in all of recorded history of a nation with millions of people and no king. Mm-hmm. And so Israel was the first nation with a concept of equality. Because wherever there's a king, it is hierarchical. If you are friends with the king, you're more equal. If you're not friends with the king, you're less equal. And if you are an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason, or you are a slave.
Yes.
And so in Israel, there was no king for 400 years. And the law said there is no respect of persons in judgment, rich or poor. Everyone's the same, male, female, made in the image of the creator. It's the beginning of the concept of equality.
And there it is. Well, you're going to have to read the book. It's called The Treacherous World of the 16th Century and How the Pilgrims Escaped It by Bill Federer. Bill, thank you so much for being with us. It was a delight to have you. And we'll be back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that helps people struggling with credit card debt. Their number is 800-793-8752. That's 800-793-8752 or trinitycredit.org. on Janet Mefford today, and the memo fallout continues, and I'm sure this will reverberate for quite a while, and we've learned a whole lot of things since Friday's release of the memo. And if you've not been brought up to speed, you can read it, obviously, online. It's been released. It's been unclassified. It is no surprise whatsoever that those on the left are discounting it, acting like it's no big deal, screaming and yelling about it. It's interesting to gauge all the different reactions from different corners of leftist world. And all it does is just prove the point that what was done was horrible, and they either have to downplay it or they have to act as if Trump is the worst guy in the whole world and double down on exposing Trump for so-called Russian collusion. And by the way, the president says that he's been vindicated here, although there are some Republicans, including Trey Gowdy, who was involved in putting the memo together, who said, not necessarily. We'll get into that in just a few minutes. But I want to play the most unhinged reaction that I've heard. There have been quite a few. You can go online and spend hours listening to all the crazy reactions to the memo that was released on Friday, revealing such horrible things about this abuse of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, this dossier that was created by Christopher Steele. And many people are even saying, as Diana West mentioned to me last week, that the way it reads, it doesn't even seem as if somebody who wrote it was a native speaker of the English language. That's a whole separate question. But this dossier was brought to the FISA court, and it was used to justify a surveillance warrant to be used in the Trump investigation with Carter Page. And now, as it turns out, they didn't reveal any of the information about Carter Page that would have been potentially favorable to his case. And we have all these warrants that targeted him. The FBI and the DOJ obtained one initial FISA warrant targeting Carter Page and three FISA renewals from the court. And all these people involved, James Comey, the former director of the FBI, signed three of these FISA applications in question on behalf of the FBI. You had Andrew McCabe, the deputy director, signing one, and you had Sally Yates and Rod Rosenstein also involved later on. But I thought it was quite telling that all of the favorable information that could have been put forward to the FISA court just wasn't mentioned. As the memo says, in the case of Carter Page, the government had at least four independent opportunities before this court to accurately provide an accounting of the relevant facts, but the material and the relevant information was omitted. And it's just very, very obvious that this was a politically motivated takedown, especially when you go into the later parts of the memo and you see how much Steele disliked Trump. This whole thing is just a boondoggle. At any rate, let's get to this reaction. Donnie Deutsch over on MSNBC. Listen to this for a moment and consider the level of rhetoric to which the left will debase itself. I really want to use that on purpose, debase itself, to engage in this insane hyperbole to get the scent off the DNC, off the Hillary Clinton campaign, off Barack Obama and all of his cronies in the deep state. Listen to this. This is Cut 5.
Here's what's going on here. I don't want to talk about a memo. We've got a dozen instances of clearly the Russians colluding in this election with top Trump officials. Two have already been convicted. We have a guy, a president, who clearly is owned by Putin. We have an investigation going. Okay, that's good news. We basically now have a press release that's been put out, that's been twisted and mangled, that now will give this president permission to fire Rosenstein, who will now take over this investigation. Our democracy is under siege. People need to start taking to the streets. This is a dictator. This is not something to analyze anymore. Yeah. This is not a good day for Trump.
Yeah.
This is frightening stuff if you are an American. If you're somebody who's 80 years old and sitting at home and you've watched the greatness of this country, you should be terrified. And if you're a 12-year-old and the future is in front of you, this is terrifying. This is not time to analyze and pundit. People, we need a revolution at this point. And I'm not doing TV here, and I'm not going, crazy Donnie. Well, this is what's going on.
Okay, well, let's just think about this for a moment. He uses the word dictator to describe Donald Trump. How is it the action of a dictator to release all of this information about how the DNC and the Clinton campaign paid for this dossier and used it as evidence to get surveillance permission to go after Carter Page without revealing the favorable information about Carter Page. We now know that Steele participated in media stories that then were turned around and used as evidence when he was the source in the first place. And we know that he was anti-Trump. We've got all the Strzok Page. Who's the dictator here? How are you a dictator for releasing a memo that shows high levels of corruption in the Democratic Party? Well, he becomes a dictator when the left gets so spooked and so terrified. And I will agree with him that it's terrifying, although I wouldn't say it's terrifying for the same reasons that Donnie Deutsch thinks it's terrifying. What's terrifying is the level of corruption in the federal government and how terrifying it is that had Hillary Clinton become the president in 2016 rather than Donald Trump, none of us would know about this right now. None of us would know about this. Now, you could say, well, it wouldn't have happened because if Trump hadn't won, then there would have been no need to go through all this stuff. No, think about it for a moment. Look at all the actors mentioned. The Fusion GPS, Glenn Simpson, Lisa Page, Peter Strzok, James Comey, all of these people, Christopher Steele. Who were these Russians that they talked to? All the rest. So he's talking about Trump being a dictator. He's talking about people needing to take to the streets. And he's talking about revolution. That sounds pretty Russian to me. Maybe I'm misreading this, but it seems to me that revolution and taking to the streets, doesn't that sound like it's crossing some sort of a line here, a revolution? You know, the only revolution that we've ever talked about favorably in the United States of America during my lifetime has been the American Revolution, in which we threw off the chains of the British system and said, no, we're Americans and we're going to rule ourselves, we the people. And there were brave men who fought and died to secure our freedom and liberty as Americans, to have religious freedom and to have all of the Bill of Rights that apply to us now. And, you know, the fact that we have a country today is due to the fact that there were a number of early Americans who said, we will be free. That's it. We will not be ruled by the British. We are going to be free. It's just incredible to me. Somehow I don't think that he's talking about that sort of a revolution. I think he's talking about a revolution that none of us ever want to see in our lifetimes occur in the streets of the United States. This is where the left is going, folks. That's why I think that that quote is so telling. That quote is so telling because it really summarizes the way a lot of people on the left actually think. What we need to do if we don't like what's going on is we need to have a revolution. We need to go into the streets. This is communist talk. It just is. This is not the way Americans historically have resolved anything. Aside, clearly, from the American Revolution, what I'm talking about is in a mature republic, we have laws, we have the rule of law, we have the U.S. Constitution, we have the judicial system, we have an entire system of government that is set up to help us resolve disputes. If we don't like people who are in the federal government and serving at the pleasure of the people, then we can throw them out. We can impeach them. We can vote them out of office. We have all sorts of checks and balances on our government to make sure that a corrupt government doesn't take hold and we can deal with it. What we don't advocate as Americans is revolution. And people who talk like that, people who stress that we need a revolution, stress that we need more people screaming and yelling in the streets, are people who scare me far more than this memo does. Because frankly, the only thing scary about this memo is the fact that any of this was going on in the first place. That's what's scary about the memo. That's what's really upsetting about the memo. And by the way, there are more memos to come. And this is something that Devin Nunes talked about, in fact, with Brett Baer when he discussed this entire thing when the whole memo was released on Friday. I'm going to get to that in just a moment. But there's more to come. Here's what's really going to be interesting to watch and probably scary to watch, and that is how the left deals with these revelations. They're lying. They're just lying. And it's going to be obvious and it's going to be expected that more lies will come around. They have to lie. That's what they do. And they have to lie now because they've been caught. So what do? Just double down. Just lie some more. Lie some more. Lie some more. Lie some more. And it's just going to be an avalanche. The question is whether or not the American people are going to be wise enough to see through it. And when we come back, I want you to listen to some of what Devin Nunes had to say about this whole situation with this memo and the left's reaction in particular. We're going to come back. Don't go away. We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today.
Hi, I'm Kevin Sorbo. I wanted to invite you to offer your full support for the Ministry of Preborn and its leader, Dan Steiner. The team at Preborn is very focused and very successful at saving preborn babies from abortion. Now get ready to write down the phone number and the website so you can join the Preborn team.
Join Kevin Sorbo and me, Janet Mefford, as we support Preborn. The mission at Preborn is to supply pregnancy centers throughout America with sonograms. Ultrasounds are a game changer when it comes to saving babies' lives. You see, when an abortion-minded woman sees her baby on ultrasound and hears the heartbeat, she's 80% more likely to keep her baby. For $140, you can save five babies' lives. To donate, dial #250 and say keyword baby, or donate securely at preborn.com. Your love can save a life. Call 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229.
Every baby deserves to be born. God bless.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. Well, pray for this country. You're listening to Janet Mefford today. We certainly need to be praying for the president, for the vice president, for the cabinet, and for all of the brave people in government who are doing their best to unearth the deep state and expose the corruption. We have this memo now, unclassified. I'm so glad that it came out, and it really is bombshell after bombshell, talking about the abuses at the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation related to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Carter Page sure had a good day on Friday. But the left is not happy. They're digging in and they are not telling the truth. Now, Brett Baer over at Fox News interviewed Devin Nunes shortly after the memo was released on Friday. And here's how this clip starts, just so I can set this up for you. He plays a clip of a CNN interview. So the first thing you're going to hear is Jake Tapper over on CNN interviewing Representative Eric Swalwell, a Democrat who serves on the House Intelligence Committee. And Swalwell claims that the FISA court was told about the political nature of the dossier. Now, that's something the memo contradicts. The memo says that this dossier clearly was political in nature, but that was not conveyed to the FISA court when they were seeking this warrant. He denies that. So you're going to hear Tapper with Swalwell. Then you're going to hear Brett Baer and Devin Nunes' reaction to this. Listen to cut one.
Is there anything inappropriate, do you think, about a partisan political document, the Steele dossier, being used in an application to surveil an associate of a presidential candidate, in this case, Carter Page, especially if that fact is not disclosed in the application? Is that inherently wrong, do you think?
Jake, that fact was disclosed. It was disclosed to the FISA court that part of the evidence was from a politically motivated source.
True? No. I mean, this is the things I said earlier. I mean, these guys tell so many lies, you can't keep track of them.
That's not true.
No. The court was not made aware. And I would think that a judge, if the judge knew that, hey, we're opening it, we have an investigation of the Trump campaign, we're going after this Trump campaign advisor, and oh, by the way, Hillary Clinton's campaign paid for all this information. If that did happen, which it didn't, but if that court did know that, the judge would have to be, considered very suspect. But I don't believe that happened at all.
All right. Now, what about James Comey? James Comey has become this tweeter extraordinaire since he was fired from the FBI. He comes out with this tweet on Friday. That's it. And goes on and talks. Oh, big deal. Who cares? What's the big deal about all this? What was Devin Nunes' reaction to the reaction to the memo by FBI Director, former FBI Director James Comey. Listen to what he said. This is cut two.
Well, Mr. Comey had a chance in January, February, March, April, I believe all the way till June, to come clean on who paid for the dossier. He was asked about it in January, and he said very clearly that he knew that Republicans had started the dossier, which was a lie. And then when asked and probed further, well, who finished the dossier, he didn't know. Now, maybe he was lying, maybe he didn't know, but both seem to be a problem. So Mr. Comey's welcome to come back. Tell us when exactly he learned that the Democratic Party and the Hillary Clinton campaign paid for the dossier. He's welcome to come back and share that information. But I think the American people understand that the FBI should not go to secret courts using information that was paid for by the Democrats to open up investigations and get warrants on people of the other political party. That's the type of stuff that happens in banana republics.
Exactly right. So Comey, Mr. Clean, maybe not. Maybe not so clean. It's just amazing, isn't it? They're just out there lying. They're just lying. Now, what about the dossier itself? Are there parts of that dossier that are actually true? This is something that Nunes discusses, and then he explains who's really guilty of Russian collusion. This is cut three.
Russia is a country and Carter Page is a person? I mean, other than that, I don't know anything.
So you don't know anything that's been corroborated by intel as a part of that dossier?
No, very little. And I think if you actually look at that dossier from the beginning, I don't know what FBI agent, what they were smoking, that they would think that Carter Page, who's somebody who hasn't had a job for many years, who is obviously a Russian sympathizer, but that somehow the Russians, who actually said he was an idiot in court testimony, this was presented before the court. So Russian agent said that Carter Page was an idiot. And do you think that the Russians were going to offer him like a 19% share of the major oil company in Russia? I mean, this is crazy. And so when somebody first reads that dossier, I would think you would come away from that and think, okay, this is really pretty wild. This is wild stuff. In fact, it was probably, there's a good chance, let's not forget where the dossier came from. It came from Russians. So there's clear evidence of collusion with the Russians. It just happens to be with the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee that the news media fails to talk about or fails to even investigate.
There it is, because that's not what they do. That's not what they do. They enjoy collusion as well, CNN in particular. CNN, WikiLeaks, remember all that stuff that came out during the 2016 campaign? The extent to which CNN was in bed with the Democratic National Committee and Donna Brazile and feeding questions to Hillary and all the rest. This has already been exposed to some extent. And you've had Trump call them fake news ever since he's gotten into office. We need a much stronger term than fake news. It's just incredible. I mean, the media's responsibility is extremely significant, not doing their jobs. They're so concerned about backing up their own side, the Democratic side, they don't want to tell the truth. And the fact of the matter is, if you're really going to be a good newsman, if you're really going to be a good reporter or a good journalist, you have to have a commitment to principle that is above people. That is, you have to be committed to the truth, the telling of the truth, and to moral right and moral wrong, and knowing the difference and standing up for what is right and just and ethical, regardless of who the corrupt person is. Well, Nunes then drops this bombshell. Listen to this, cut four.
So this completes just the FISA abuse portion of our investigation. We are in the middle of what I call phase two of our investigation, which involves other departments, specifically the State Department and some of the involvement that they had in this. That investigation is ongoing, and we continue to work towards finding answers and asking the right questions to try to get to the bottom of what exactly the State Department was up to in terms of this Russian investigation.
Very good. So the State Department will be next. We'll see how many memos come forth after this is all over. But pray for him. Pray for those who are working diligently to try to uproot and expose all this darkness. Trey Gowdy said there might be about five FBI employees whose actions have been suspect in the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. He actually said the whole bureau doesn't deserve to be attacked. This was when he was on Face the Nation yesterday. And he said, I have tremendous respect for the bureau. There are 30,000 employees. Let's assume that there are five that engaged in conduct that we have questions about. The FBI, of course, under siege through this entire situation. But apparently today, Democrats are wanting to release their own memo. This is something, again, that Nunes has talked about. He said, I've read the Democrats' memo once. I need to read it again. We need to put it through that whole process that we put the first memo through. So it is reported over at the New York Times that as Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee back away from President Trump's claim that he's completely vindicated, Democrats are now pressing for the release of their own classified rebuttal, with a vote expected today on whether or not to make it public. The memo that the panel's Republicans released on Friday, as they claim, they say this, the claims that federal law enforcement officials abused their powers to spy on a former Trump campaign official claims. This is supposed to be the ultimate newspaper in the United States of America, it claims. Are you really accusing the House Intelligence Committee of being a bunch of liars? The people who put this together, you really think Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy are a bunch of liars? Who are the liars? Read the memo. You can figure it out for yourself. Check those interviews that have been done with these leftists. Who's really lying? Who has the motivation to lie? Who has the motivation to lie? Because even these Republicans, as I mentioned before, Trey Gowdy was one of them, said, well, this isn't necessarily the case that President Trump is completely vindicated in this Mueller probe. The Mueller probe needs to continue and we'll see what comes of it. I think they probably do need to do that just to tie all the ends together. You don't want to make everything so political that you don't allow things to proceed. I think the whole thing is ridiculous, but, you know, I guess go forward with it. Prove that it's ridiculous. I guess that's what you have to do. But I will take issue with what Donnie Deutsch had to say when he was saying, oh, you've already had two Trump officials who were indicted in relation to this Russian collusion. There was nothing. Manafort, that wasn't connected to the Trump campaign being in collusion with Russia. So he doesn't even know what he's talking about. He's too focused on revolution. And I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what is so important for us to keep in mind as Christians, and that is what the Word of God says. Proverbs 29:2, when the righteous increase, the people rejoice, but when the wicked rule, the people groan. That is so true. This hour of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you by Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that helps people struggling with credit card debt. 800-793-8752 or trinitycredit.org. And from Pure Flix comes the biblical story of the last of the Hebrew judges, Samson, rated PG-13, maybe inappropriate for children under 13. Samson in theaters February 16th. More information is available at samson.movie.